From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, for the first time, Boston's top law enforcement officials are African American.
This is not your grandfather's incarceration facility any longer. As we all know, this country incarcerates far too many of its citizens.
The one-size-fits-all justice system has not been working. We will be holding people accountable, but jail is going to be the last option.
It shows that any kid in Boston, and we were poor and we made it, will have the opportunity to be the mayor, the commissioner, or chief if we all work together.
Do these new leaders and new state legislation mean the system is changing?
The agreement that we've reached today is about lifting people up instead of locking them up. It's about cutting the chains that hold people down when they're trying to get back up on their feet.
Boston's criminal justice leaders join us, and we'll take your calls next on Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. A little over a month ago, a report came out with an astonishing statistic. 64% of the adults in the United States have a family member who has spent at least one night in jail or prison. That's a lot of personal experience with the criminal justice system, which is what we want to spend the next hour talking about. We're having this conversation with three criminal justice leaders in Boston who some say could help transform not just the criminal justice system, but racial attitudes.
And you ought to remember this moment. The beginning of the change that will occur in the city of Boston, Massachusetts.
That's the Reverend Jeffrey Brown at a Martin Luther King celebration earlier this month, talking about new leadership in Boston, which has made this the first time that the city's law enforcement leaders are all people of color. And they're with us in studio today. Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins, who officially took office this month. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Also with us, Boston Police Commissioner William Gross, who took office this summer.
Thank you for the invitation.
Glad you could come in. Also, Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins, who served as sheriff since 2013.
Yes, ma'am. Yep.
Thank you for coming in, sir.
Thank you.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you have personal experience with the criminal justice system? Where does the system need reform? Where does it work best? And what do you see as the main public safety challenges in Boston? How should we deal with racial disparities? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-8255. Talk. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston, and you can watch this conversation on Radio Boston's Facebook page, where you can leave a comment there as well, and that's at the Facebook Live video section. Okay, so let's make it clear from the top. Nobody is anybody's boss, so you can all speak freely here. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. All right, good. So I guess we heard that clip from Reverend Brown at the beginning, saying that this was an era of change in Boston. And Rachel Rollins, let's start with you. What's change going to look like, do you think, in 2019 for criminal justice and the criminal justice system?
So I think change is going to have a female voice to it. If we've looked at just general elections across not only Boston, but Suffolk County and the nation, women are stepping up a lot. In the criminal justice system, you know, and the sheriff will talk about this, unfortunately, one of the largest populations of growing prisoners is women. Right. And in particular, in the Black community, we have women that are home handling family matters while, unfortunately, when Black men are incarcerated and we see numbers that are significantly higher for certain populations, it's the women that are holding the family in place at home, visiting their loved one, son, husband, boyfriend in prison, and then also raising children. So I think the face of law enforcement is changing because there's a female voice there. And then far more importantly, I think, and I look to my left and my right here, is the people that are actually overrepresented in the criminal justice system are now finally making the decision. So what's beautiful is we have a sheriff who has a lived experience that is different than maybe mine or others, but certainly knows what it feels like to be a person of color, a black man walking through the world. And we have a commissioner that has experienced that as well, but also comes to the table with a wealth of other experiences that make them, I think, exceptional for the role.
What do you think we'll see in terms of change in 2019 regarding criminal justice? Sheriff Tompkins.
The criminal justice bill that just came out that the legislators put forth, I think for the most part, is a pretty darn good bill. It speaks to a lot of things that's important to, I think, all three of us. What I would have liked to have seen, and I hope they go back to correct this, if that's the right word, there isn't enough money for aftercare. And so if
or reentry programs, is that right?
Reentry, aftercare. Reentry? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm saying aftercare because a lot of the people that are with me now have substance abuse issues or mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And so as they transition out, they're going to need a continuum of care. And the legislators did not put enough money into that bill to address that. Mm-hmm. But I think they addressed a whole host of issues. But I think that, you know, when they look at it again and go back, there's a few things that they can tweak. Insofar as what it's going to look like, when you have three people of color now occupying the positions that we occupy, I would like to think that particularly communities of color will see the three of us and have a dialogue with us that they may not have had with others that did not look like them, did not walk in their shoes. Mm-hmm. And I think it's incumbent upon us to try to foster that conversation, but it's got to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. We can't have that conversation once or twice. It's got to be an ongoing conversation. But the communities that we're representing have to work with us.
Commissioner Ross.
Yes.
Your ideas on 2019 as being the year of change, and what does this mean when we have, for the first time in Boston, three people of color in charge of the major law enforcement agencies?
First of all, change comes about for a reason. I believe a part of that change is that we should never, ever forget or dismiss anyone's negative experiences with the judicial system or law enforcement. Once you acknowledge things did happen in the past, both good and bad, then and only then can you have a legitimate conversation about how people want to be policed and what justice looks like for them. So my colleagues here hit it on the head. We have to start listening to the voice of the people and mm-hmm. how they want to be policed and find out exactly what they know about the criminal justice system. So the educational component for 2019 should be key. Let people know where they stand, what programs are available, right. What we do as a district attorney, as a Suffolk County sheriff, and as a commissioner, what we do, how we serve the community, and how we can help problem solve together and move forward. From judges to DAs to sheriffs to commissioners, we should now educate the people about exactly what we do. Because I'm telling you right now, a lot of folks in the neighborhoods, they don't know hardly anything about the criminal justice system except, hey, these two lock them up and he keeps them.
Right.
No, we have to broaden our horizons, and it begins with education. And then we can move forward and collaboratively create programs and initiatives that benefit our entire community.
District Attorney Rollins, during your campaign, you released that list of 15 crimes. I know it's gotten a lot of attention for first-time offenders, for which you said you would not seek jail time. And then there were stories that said you were sort of taking another look at that. Mm-hmm. Where do you stand now?
So I love to say that the commissioner says out loud all the times, cuffs as a last resort, meaning handcuffs as a last resort. My list is based on the fact that I'd like incarceration to be the last thing on a checklist of what we determine is going to happen with certain people. And absolutely in the district court or the divisions of the Boston Municipal Court. When you are up in Superior Court, indicted up into Superior Court, it's far more serious charges that we're dealing with. So what I want to say is the list of 15 still exists. It is absolutely something I firmly believe in. But as you said, what we're going to be doing is meeting with law enforcement, meeting with the commissioner, who I have met with several times, Chief Delahunty in Winthrop, who I do want to make sure we are respectful of him. There was a death in the Winthrop police family recently. We just honored his brother, Michael. We have the police chief in Chelsea and in Revere as well. We're going to be meeting and talking about what I'm proposing, because ultimately I want you guys to hear, decline to prosecute does not mean do nothing. It means, as you've heard these gentlemen say, the overwhelming number of people that come into contact with the criminal justice system in the divisions of Boston Municipal Court or the District Court are dealing with a mental health issue, substance abuse, or just are poor. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's right that we're putting them in jail for those ailments. I think they need services, not sentences. And if ultimately they it's determined that they should be sent over to my colleague on the right, then we will have gone through
the sheriff.
I'm on the left.
He's on the left. We will have gone through a list of things to see, is that appropriate there?
So it sounds a little bit different from what you initially proposed in your campaign. You will certainly not immediately prosecute first-time offenders for low-level offenses. However, if it is more complicated than that, and the picture looks a little more complicated, there might be other things that happen that would make someone go to your colleague on
the
right.
Sure, and what I want to say is, if people actually read my one-page proposal, from the moment I put it up there, it said with supervisory oversight, right? So in district courts and divisions of the BMC, those are our youngest prosecutors. Those are people that can get a job right out of law school. And they're very bright, don't get me wrong, but they don't have the experience of, you know, I've been a lawyer for 20 years. There are supervisors I have with 5-7 years of experience. I'm simply saying, before they charge somebody with a crime in those 15 instances, I want a supervisor looking at it, and I want some different eyes looking at the situation. So it's very consistent with what I said before, which was, if we're going to charge you, there's going to be supervisory oversight.
Commissioner Gross, your thoughts?
Yes. I'm glad you brought this question up, because when the list came out, folks tried to get my comment, and I said I didn't talk to the district attorney yet, elect at that time. And I want to see how she contextualized what she said about her list. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad we had the conversation. We talked about first-time offenders, and we talked about discretion. She's the district attorney. She can exercise her rights to prosecute or not, and we exercise our right as law enforcement to arrest or not. But what we have in common here is we've always had diversion programs, and there was something called continued without a finding. Mm-hmm. If persons adhere to the conditions that judges set forth and they didn't reoffend, then they wouldn't have a criminal record. So I do say cuffs are a last resort, right? We're willing to give breaks to first-time offenders. I am not willing to give breaks to repeat violent offenders. And thank you again for bringing this question forth, because there is a sense out in the communities that are we forgotten about if we're store owners, and where's our sense of justice, and why are the bad guys always getting breaks? That's not the case here. My two colleagues here, we have discussions all the time about justice for people who are victims. In no way will we forget victims, but we will have diversion programs. We will work with people. Again, I have no wiggle room for repeat violent offenders. If they cannot be rehabilitated on this side, that's something we talk about all the time too, then folks have to be rehabilitated on the other side. Mm-hmm. And when they're on the other side, the programs and initiatives that we have in place must be fully funded so that we can help those behind bars, because one day they're going to return to society. So.
Okay. I want to make sure we get some calls in, and I'm going to let you weigh in on this too, Sheriff. But we've got Jasmine calling from Dorchester. And Jasmine, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to say, you know, I grew up in Boston Public Schools, and my father was in prison for most of my life. I was in and out of the system since he was 14. He also had mental illness and drug abuse problems. And the difference I see now with, you know, from what can I imagine my father went through and growing up with, you know, brown boys, black boys, and Boston Public Schools, is that there was more programs for jobs and things to do in the summer and after school that I feel like my father didn't really have, or my parents don't really talk about having those opportunities. And I feel like if we have more, keep kids busy, because I got a job. I've got a job when I was in high school. There was actually in the career center. They had a guy. I don't even know the program name or even if it's still there. But he would help you with your resume. He would get you jobs from the local community. So I went to Brighton High School and I worked up the street at Action Beer and Company. And he could only afford to have one person a year work for him. And I got paid $9 an hour filing invoices. And there I was exposed to adult conversations. I learned how to be professional, how to make money, save money. And those are things that kids need to learn. I was occupied. I wasn't hanging around across the street at the Burger King. I was like, I got to go to work. And people are like, you work? And I'm like, yeah, you got to do this program. It's awesome. Do your resume. They'll help you get a job. And so those kids actually did follow my lead. Some didn't. And I feel like if anything has changed in a good way, because I know maybe the conversation might turn a lot negative, is that since what my father went through, is that there's just way more opportunities out there. And I think that if the school system, the Boston police system as well, because there are Boston school police that I feel like need to be more involved, because they're the first police we see for most part of the day. We don't see the regular police. We see the school police. And they need to be more involved as far as helping kids instead of yelling at them, because all of the time we were scared of them. And so they're the first line of defense, and they can see problems and get with the community, say, hey, man, you should do this program, or hey, man, stop doing that. You know, you can do better for yourself. And that wasn't really happening. The school police just stayed in their offices. We never really saw
Jasmine?
Them, only in the beginning of the day or at the end of the day. And
Jasmine.
I feel like I would like the school police to be more involved.
Okay, Jasmine, we're going to ask the commissioner to respond to that and also talk a little bit about preventative programming and what we know about how that might help. Commissioner.
Jasmine, great question. And oftentimes, folks, when we receive constructive criticism, it also allows us the opportunity to educate folks. There is the school police, but we are the Boston Police School Unit. So we Boston Police, we have volunteers, officers that are handpicked that are part of our school police unit. And then you have uniformed Boston School Police. So there's a total separation. Mm-hmm. My officers don't wear uniforms. They're not in the offices. They're in schools from kindergarten all the way to Harvard. And we have several programs and initiatives that focus on the needs and concerns of the student, their well-being, anything having to do with gangs, gang violence, mediation. We represent that, and we represent that well. As well, you do need programs. I am a product of ABCD program, YES, and people always coming and looking to provide opportunities.
Right.
And for me, as I was growing up in a tough neighborhood, Esmond Street. So I sought guidance and received guidance from programs that were set forth. And we have plenty of those in the city of Boston. And it's a great time to give a shout out to our private sector, too. They come forward. They help fund programs and initiatives that benefit the young people in the city of Boston.
Right. So, and
I make one comment?
Yep.
I'm sorry. So, Jasmine, first of all, shout out to Brighton High School. My dad was a guidance counselor there. But if your dad is a person of color, one of the things I want to make sure, and I'm sorry to hear that he was in and out of prison and suffered from mental health issues and addiction. But you know, what is really frustrating to me, and I think we need to talk a lot about it, is now that the people who are suffering from addiction look different, it's miraculously a health issue that every single person in the world now talks about, and we need to be very, you know, we can't give these people records. Like, this is terrible because they could actually be your family. And when it was people that look like individuals on this side of the table, and I am referring to the three black people that are on your show, nobody cared about the fact that the crack epidemic or heroin was ravaging our communities and people were addicted and they were just sent to jail. So I feel in the vein of the commissioner, we have to say that out loud because communities are going to call BS on us immediately if we're smiling and saying, like, you're right, Concord has a terrible heroin problem. And nobody is saying that that isn't true. But unless you say, wow, how hypocritical that our government now suddenly seems to care when it looks like them, but when it looked like us, they didn't, it's a problem.
Mm, right. So, but seriously, how do you address that? I mean,
what you do is you say it out loud every chance you can get.
Yes.
And what you say is, we have to make sure that when I, as the DA, or this is the commissioner, or Sheriff Tompkins, when we're talking about aftercare, when I'm talking about sending people to programs instead of over to the sheriff, I want to make sure are only white people getting the best treatment when it comes to addiction services? What does the diversity look like in these programs that are getting all of this money? There are disparities everywhere. Mm. And what I'm excited about as a new set of eyes is I want to see, what does this organization look like? What is the system that gets you into this program? And by the way, all these programs, Commissioner, that our mayor, Mayor Walsh, is funding in Boston, all these people from outside of Boston are coming in to get our resources, which is fine. Mm. But I believe the people of Boston should get the system and the resources for Boston first before people from, you know, all of these other towns are coming in, taking our services, and then leaving and going back to where they are.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to have to take a break.
Thank you, Jasmine.
Great question, Jasmine.
We've got other folks waiting to also ask some questions, and I want to remind listeners that we want to hear from you as well. Join the conversation by calling 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet at Radio Boston. With me in studio is Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins, Boston Police Commissioner William Gross, Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins. We'll take your calls in a minute. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, and we're talking about the criminal justice system with three of Boston's top law enforcement officials, and we're taking your calls. With me in studio, Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins, Boston Police Commissioner William Gross, Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins, and join the conversation. What areas of the criminal justice system do you think need to change, and what are some of the biggest public safety challenges? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also watch this conversation live on Radio Boston's Facebook page, where you can leave a comment on our Facebook Live video. And before the break, we were talking about, I think, really what sounds like an issue of trust. Trust in the system on all fronts. And so you're coming in as the first time that the major law enforcement leaders in the city of Boston are people of color. But there's been a lot of mistrust. And even though, say, we're saying, okay, we're not going to lock up people as our way out of a public health crisis or other crisis, there's a lack of trust because of the history of that and how folks of different races have been treated differently. So I wonder, how do you instill trust in this system from all levels? And I wonder if we start with you, Commissioner, because you're the first one, right? You're the first encounter that someone might have with the criminal justice system. Before then, we make it to the prosecutorial level and then possibly the incarceration level. So what do you do to improve trust or to get people to trust in the system?
To have an honest conversation, you have to be honest. You have to acknowledge history, both negative and positive. That's the first step. You will not have a legitimate conversation if you deny that there were wrongdoings at the hands of the criminal justice system. There was good and bad. You know, it's not just all negative. But just have an honest conversation about the past. By example, the mid-90s, the whole culture in the country was crack cocaine, lock everybody up, throw away the key. It led to mass incarceration.
Some people still in jail.
Right, right. But now, there's an opioid crisis. We know that you can't lock that problem away. You can't lock dependencies away, that the onus is on everyone, not just law enforcement, to handle this problem of addiction. That wasn't the case in the mid-90s. So you acknowledge what happened in the past. Use those as teachable learning moments And then, and only then, can you have a legitimate conversation about where your department is now. Mm. And again, the educational process is key. You have to show, if you're a chief or a commissioner, how your city and town and your local law enforcement deal with issues that we see happening across the country that resulted in riots in Ferguson or South Carolina or Baltimore. Oftentimes, police agencies are very humble, but now's the time to market what you do and how you serve the community. By example, BPD, the Boston Police Department, is a major metropolis that has a standalone policy on bias-free policing. We teach our officers as well, especially in the academy, fair and impartial policing, procedural justice, de-escalation. But guess what, folks? That's not just from the books. We bring in people from the community that we serve to help teach us. So when we say community policing, that's not just a jaded moniker thrown out. This is truly a village concept where you can help us, and we together can help police our village. Mm.
District Attorney Rollins.
Yeah, and I want to sort of push back a little bit. The black community, we're victims as well, right? So remember, oftentimes defendants have been victims themselves, and victims turn into defendants one day, depending if for the people that actually are engaged in the criminal justice system, those groups are interchangeable. So many times the first time a family comes into contact, depending on where you live in Suffolk County, with the police or district attorney's office is because their loved one was the victim of a homicide, they're a survivor of homicide or a violent crime. And what is very frustrating to communities is, on the one hand, we have a lot of unsolved homicides, which the commissioner's talked about and I've talked about, and we're going to work on trying to solve. But then we have this mass incarceration problem. So for petty, low-level offenses, non-serious crimes, you can arrest us and throw away the key, but you can't solve our homicides? Like, it's,
you're talking about the Washington Post report that found that there was a different clearance rate.
There's different clearance rates, and irrespective of those numbers, what I can say is communities, generally speaking, it's trust. Let's add to this marijuana, right? Mm-hmm. So black people and Latino people are sitting in jail as a result of many marijuana crimes. We as the Commonwealth of Massachusetts have now legalized not just medicinal but recreational marijuana. And it is a billion, with a B, a billion-dollar industry that not a single, very few black people are millionaires as a result of marijuana in the Commonwealth. And now, yet again, there are racial disparities on who has medicinal marijuana distilleries, I think they're called, or dispensaries.
Dispensaries.
Some D letter. Dispensaries, right, are not owned by the very people that are sitting in jail rotting. So we can't even get the benefit of marijuana. What I will say, and so that hypocrisy needs to be spoken about. One shout out I will say to the commissioner that I think is great is your promotion of Michael Cox. Right. And there's a history there. And there's a story in a book about the fence and a black eye, quite frankly, on the Boston Police Department, that this commissioner promoted that man who, you know, you can talk about later, but I think is a beautiful move to show that we can move past bad behavior and excellence can be rewarded. Okay. So
yes,
we can get to that story in a minute, but we have full lines that I want to get to. And I still have to give the sheriff just
a... I love the comment about the clearance rate on homicides. Mm. We go where the evidence leads us. The district attorney knows full well that if we have evidence, then we can bring the case forward. But something rings true as well. When you build trust with the community will come forward help. And guess what? They have done so several times, but unfortunately the media... we have had many missing people, and people in the community has helped us out. It wasn't just Miss Ambrose. Look at Charlestown. As soon as we went to the community, that's very diverse, by the way, people came forward, and they were happy. We found a 14-year-old girl that same day, but there's issues with her privacy that we couldn't really bring forward.
Right.
But guess what, folks? People in the community are helping. The times you call 911, when we have conversations, we're building levels of trust. That's how you get clearance rates, and we don't need to hear from the Washington Post.
Okay.
They're in Washington.
All right. Sheriff, trust. Trust in the community and trust in the system after years of issues.
So let me say this. The DA,
mentioned, looking at the situation with a new set of eyes. And so that's what we need. We need some innovation, some creativity in so far as the programming that we offer and how we decide who is going to jail and who is not going to jail. I'll just speak from my perch. What we've done is we've created several programs that helps people move through the system, and hopefully we're interrupting the cycle of criminality and recidivism. Mm-hmm. Really quickly, we began a program called Family Matters, where we've taken cohorts from the most dysfunctional households, and we said, let us wrap our arms around the people at home, particularly if there are kids at home. Mm-hmm. Here's the situation. A lot of people at home don't know where the social service agencies exist, or if they where they are, or if they exist at all. We do. And so if you have some situations that need to be addressed, you don't know how to find those agencies, that's where the Sheriff's Department has intervened. We began a program called the Peace Program, where we've taken the 18 to 24 right. year olds.
We did a story about it. Mm-hmm, and media. Excellent. Yep. Just pointing excellent. It out.
Yep. And media. Yeah, you're gonna love it.
Great program.
Yeah. Yeah. And, well, we put them in a separate unit unto themselves because the brain is still maturing.
Right,
and so
right.
we can get to them and offer them a different education curriculum, mostly based on vocational education, that there also interrupts the cycle of criminality. And then finally, we have a program that we call OASIS, where we took one of our units, and it's a 64-bed, 28-day detox unit. Mm-hmm. And the DA Rollins predecessor, and I believe DA Rollins is still working with us, Dan Conley and the judges said, look, if you have a low-level, nonviolent offender that's a substance abuse user, let's send them to the detox side at the Suffolk County Sheriff's Department versus the penal side. Mm. Let's get them clean and sober, and then let's hand them off to an agency that can continue that care. That's why I talk about the criminal justice bill. We need that money to be able to hand them off. These are the things that we have to do in criminal justice so that people really understand that we do care about them. It's not just lock them up and throw away the keys anymore.
Not
and I've got to tell
you,
and I got to tell you, frankly, you know, I got to say this, and I'm not going to speak for my colleagues here, but as a man of color, the reason I took the job I started as director of communications, moved up to the sheriff, is because there are so many people that look exactly like me in jail. You know, but for happenstance, I could be in jail. You know, you've heard the thing of, black while walking. Now, that might sound facetious or might sound flippant, but it's a reality in communities of color. And so I think part of my job is to create programming to say to the individuals that are with me and the families that love them that we really care about your kids and we want to keep them out of the system. And so working in tandem, that's the message that we have to continuously get out there. And that message has to be sustainable.
Okay, I want to take some calls. Martha is calling from Groton. Martha, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I work with pre-release guys. These are low-level drug offenders. And the big issue, and this is...
And you work in a prison. And you work in a prison, Martha, with pre-release guys? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And you're, what do you do?
I do social work. I do counseling. I am not an employee of the prison. But my company has a contract with Shirley, minimum security. And so these guys are low-level drug offenders. They're heading back out to the community, and what I keep telling them is I don't want to see you in here ever again. If I see you outside, that's great. There are, what the gentleman was just saying, there are programs out there, but there's very little knowledge about them inside. I try to get guys halfway housing, whatever, job references, whatever, and you know, if these guys cannot go back to what am I going to do? I've got a record. I can't get a job. Oh, I can do this, sell drugs, whatever. They don't really want to go back there. They don't want to go back to prison. They just don't have.
So there's no. So there's
not aware
not,
of the options that are out there.
There isn't a lot of help with reentry, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Inside.
Okay. Exactly.
Okay. Sheriff, address that. I mean, maybe it's different. You know, we're talking about a state prison here. When we're talking about Shirley Minimum, you know, MCI Shirley.
Right, the Department of Correction versus the House of Correction.
Right.
And
right.
It's very different.
It is definitely two different ways of doing it. The county sheriffs, and there are 14 of us, are closer to that municipal street level. And so we have a little more wherewithal. This is not to take anything away from the DOC. They do a fantastic job. But generally, they've got their people there 5, 10, 20 lifetime. Okay. Mm-hmm. On average, my guys are there 14 months, ladies there 9 months. And so we have a better opportunity to cycle them out, get them introduced to the programs that, as the young lady just mentioned, that people just do not know exists. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to educate people to let them know where these programs are so that we can just steer them to that. But here's the other thing. We really need to look at a couple of things. We need to look at poverty. Now, poverty is a big, 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 big deal. But when you have a single mom with three kids and three or four jobs, it's going to be tough. And if the streets get a hold of those kids, bad things could potentially happen. So we really do need to look at that. We need to look at jobs, job training. We need to look at healthcare. And we need to look at housing that's affordable, not to be confused with affordable housing, because the two are vastly different, you see. And in the absence of those things, we have found that people will recidivate. And the recidivism rate in the state is 46%. So we know half the people that are going to leave us on Friday will probably be back in 3 to 6 months. We have to continuously find ways to interrupt that cycle of criminality and recidivism. And that's where my colleagues, the police and the DA, will come in play. There are, and I'll close by saying this. Most of my population, 70% of my population, presents with some form of substance abuse use. 42% mentally ill. 26% severely mentally ill. There are not enough beds outside of a correction facility for mental health and substance abuse. And so if somebody does something, they're thrown in jail. They shouldn't be.
So particularly you're the safety net.
We are the de facto mental health, substance abuse, and education system at a cost to the taxpayers of $55,000 a year, which is ludicrous, which is crazy. But we also need to look at bail. We need to look at court fees, because if you have an indigent person that can't afford a $100 bail, you put them in jail, it's going to cost taxpayers tens of thousands of dollars to feed and clothe and transport them. When you go to jail, we become your primary health care practitioner. So if you got a cold or a kidney, you need a kidney replacement. Taxpayers have to pay for that. So we have to look at ways, as the DA said, of diverting people away from jail and getting them the services they need.
Okay, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue taking your calls. Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins, Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins, Boston Police Commissioner William Gross are with me in studio. We're taking the entire hour, a special hour of Radio Boston, to talk about criminal justice reform, criminal justice in Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We're talking about the criminal justice system with three of Boston's top law enforcement officials, and we are taking your calls. With me in studio, Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins, Boston Police Commissioner William Gross, and Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins. Listeners, join in the conversation by calling 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And I want to bring up something that we were talking about a bit in the break, and I think it's relevant here on a couple of fronts. Governor Baker refiled a bill this year that would expand prosecutors' use of dangerousness hearings. And he says this would allow judges to keep more people in custody. He says he wants to give the judiciary and district attorneys more power and resources to hold people who are charged with crimes. I'm just wondering, Commissioner Gross, you've said that judges need to be held accountable. What are your thoughts about what the governor has done here?
Well, I read that bill, and it says for violent offenders. That wasn't generalized. It's for violent offenders. The people don't get it. Third, fourth, or fifth time with the gun, electronic bracelets and stay-away orders do not work. When you ask the community if you see something and say something and they do, and they're trusting you to do something about it, why is that person back on the street within weeks or a month wearing a bracelet and you're feeling as though, hey, you know what? I can't trust you. You didn't listen, and that person's back threatening our neighborhood. But with that being said, I'm glad the governor signed that reform, and here's why. I had the opportunity to meet with Chief Justice Ron Keogh, Chief Justice Fabricant, and Chief Justice Carey to talk about what I stated in a soundbite, that judges have to be held more accountable for their decision-making processes. They then educated me that judges have certain constraints. Even if it's your fourth, fifth, or sixth time with a gun, if you come before a judge, they can only look at that crime in front of them and not past convictions. The governor's bill states that, listen, you can look at past convictions. Law enforcement, clerk magistrates can look at violations of the conditions of parole or probation and hold those people until they get in front of a judge. Mm-hmm. As well, I asked of the judges if they could come and explain the judicial system pass an arraignment, and what do you know, folks? They agreed. Thus far, Judge Fabricant, Judge Carey, and Judge Ron Keough have had a meeting with the public in the community of Brockton and as well as Dorchester. Mm-hmm. It was a full house in Dorchester Court. Wow. What my colleagues have alluded to, people don't know. It's our job to come to the people and educate them. When judges, before they were judges, were prosecutors and defense attorneys, they were constantly explaining constitutional law and criminal law to the people that they served. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't change once you get a robe and you're on the bench. And I'm glad to see that we're headed in the right direction. And trust me, people in the community are sick and tired of repeat violent offenders. Bullets have no name. Mm-hmm. So we're definitely looking forward to that being voted in. And again, just to clarify, it said violent offenders.
Okay. District Attorney Rowell.
Yeah. As I like to say, this is my third week on the job. But for dangerousness hearings, if the defense bar is getting more evidence earlier from the prosecution, from the Commonwealth in these matters, that is my hope. If we are going to be using dangerousness hearings more as a tool from the prosecutor's office, then there are discovery obligations where that individual's defense attorney is going to be getting access to more information mm-hmm. earlier. So I think, you know, I'm also planning on very much so not only listening to what the commissioner has to say, but Anthony Benedetti, who is the head of CPCS, mm-hmm. Public Defenders
in Massachusetts.
I have Anthony on speed dial, and I want to make sure that before I am unilaterally making decisions, I'm not only looking at, you know, my partners in law enforcement, but every time the Commonwealth stands up and says Rollins for the Commonwealth, there's a public defender or a criminal defense attorney standing over there, you know, dancing backwards with us in this dance of the criminal justice system. I want them and their voice heard as well, and I know they have some concerns.
Okay, I want to take some calls. John is calling from Methuen. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Deborah. Thank you for taking my call. And hello, guests.
Hi.
Hello.
I think the biggest change that needs to be made is in bail. I think that nonviolent people don't need to cool their heels in jail if they can't afford bail when they can have a monitoring device on them. I'll take my comments off air.
Mm-hmm. District Attorney Rollins, I think this is probably a good question for you. What do you think about, we've heard about it in other states. There's been bail reform. What should happen in Massachusetts?
Yeah, we are, John makes a very good point to the, and as of course does the sheriff, that if somebody can't afford a $250 bail and the mass bail fund isn't helping them, they're going to end up in Nashua Street. Mm-hmm. And that $250 that they can't afford results in whatever that $55,000 a year to send them to Nashua Street. And that's just the cost there. That doesn't include the assistant district attorney that I'm paying, the CPCS or bar advocate that the state is also paying to defend them. It's just fiscally unsound for us to continue behaving this way. So I do think we can't always say in the other instance, so put a bracelet on everybody. I think there are certain people where we have to say, look, we know where this person is. What's great about the crime bill? Think about the last time, Deborah, when you got a doctor's appointment. You get a text saying, hey, see you tomorrow at your doctor's appointment. Mm-hmm. I get it. There's trust issues. Maybe they don't want to give the law enforcement their personal cell phone number. But if they're weighing between spending a couple days in Nashua Street or getting a reminder and showing up, mm-hmm. and there are people, some of your listeners might say, oh, well, why are we bending over backwards? We do this for healthcare all the time. We remind people. They're busy people. I think there are different ways that we can make sure people come back.
Yeah. So I want to just follow up with the DA said, because And I believe you've mentioned it's a case-by-case basis because there are some low-level nonviolent offenders that you can slap a bracelet on. But, and I think that the commissioner will also attest to this, that there are some people that have had a bracelet but have gone back out to continue to commit crime.
Absolutely.
And so it's on a case-by-case basis as to who gets that bracelet. But there are a lot of low-level nonviolent people that will come back to court. Let them stay home. They don't need to be in jail, but those guys and ladies that have proven that they're going to be repeat offenders or just do, like, crazy, crazy crimes, then keep them with me.
Well, obviously that's hard to predict, but here's what I'm hearing from all of
actually,
this.
It's not that hard to predict. Actually, it's not.
Well, you know better than I do.
For me, repeat violent offenders, I have no wiggle room because I know repeat violent offenders that show up every court date, but they still go out and wreak havoc in the community.
Well,
so.
Well, maybe it is more cut and dry than I'm thinking. But here's what I what I'm hearing from you. You're all saying it's case by case. If it's very violent, that's one thing. It's cut and dry. This is what we're going to do. But there has been an enormous increase in the number of cases that have been prosecuted over the past 10 or 20 years.
Correct.
Right? We've got huge. That's why there, we have a lot of plea deals and other things going on because there are so many prosecutions. How do you have the resources to take the time to text people and tell them what they're supposed to be doing, to make sure that each case is properly evaluated so someone is getting a correct sentence, so you can assess them properly and make sure that they're not a risk to the community when you've got hundreds and thousands of cases? I mean, do you understand my question?
Of course I do, but I'm terrified by the question because so we should continue the way we are and
just
blindly...
No, I'm just saying, what's our way out?
What our way out is that we are going to slow the process down. Right. I overwhelmingly, Deborah, what you're talking about is district court cases. I am not talking about the serious crimes. The commissioner and I see each other, sadly, four times this year. Since January 2nd, there have been four homicides in Boston. Right. There have been five total since because somebody was killed on January 1st. But we've handled four homicides. We know what serious crime is. That's not what I'm talking about right now. I'm talking about low-level, non-serious crimes where if we take a moment in the beginning, Deborah, to say what is going on in this person's life, what are we doing? Is this, let's do a cost-benefit analysis. I would rather wait then than in 8 months when we finally take a look, but this person's been in Nashua Street for 8 months, they've lost the one little part-time job they had or whatever housing, and then we ultimately dismiss the case then. I just want to flip it and look at the case in the beginning before we make these decisions.
And I understand that, but
I
I'm saying, do we have the resources
to do that? We do, because if we have the resources to just blindly prosecute people, then you bet we have the resources to slow down and make decisions about what is the cost-benefit analysis here. That's part of why I have signed an amicus brief with respect to bail just yesterday with the Fair and Just Prosecution group nationally, and that we are going to be looking at the bail system here in Suffolk County. I am not announcing anything yet because I still have to sit down with my partners. Don't give me
You're
another.
You're making news on the show.
No, I'm not. No, but it's wonderful. I mean, we've talked about this during the campaign, but what I'm going to say is, you know, as a candidate, when you announce a list and you try to make phone calls to people and you're one of five people, no one takes your phone calls, right? But now that I'm the DA, what's nice is I make a phone call and people call me back.
But
we are going to be talking about bail.
I took your phone call before.
He did. But go ahead. Yes. So I strongly say you bet we have the time and the resources to do that.
Okay. I want to take another call. Another John is calling. John is calling from Bridgewater. John, you're on the air.
Okay. The point I'd like to make is if we're going to deal with mass incarceration, we also have to look at the length that are being imposed.
The length of sentences?
The length of the sentences, and shorten the sentences that are being imposed. Get back to the idea that we believe in redemption and not shoot for these extremely lengthy sentences even on violent criminal cases. Mm-hmm. We've got 2 million people in jail. We could cut that in half and we'd still be way above the per capita average for European countries and countries like Japan. Mm-hmm. So we need to look at the fact that we're imposing woefully excessive sentences as one of the causes of mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm. John, this is Rachel Rollins. So thank you for your statement. One of the things I'll say as a former federal prosecutor is I remember when I moved over sort of to the criminal division and was doing work there, we'd look at sentencing recommendations and the numbers were so big that I had to take out a calculator, right? And I think as prosecutors, part of what I want to make sure that the great ADAs, assistant district attorneys in my office will do, and my predecessor, I do have to give a shout out to District Attorney Dan Conley and District Attorney John Pappas right before me, is I want to make sure my assistant district attorneys have visited the House of Corrections, have visited the Department of Corrections, have actually gone into a jail themselves, and not with a beautiful tour, but showing up without telling the sheriff and seeing, and no,
watch
you know,
out, this is a warning,
but
Sheriff.
But I'm serious. Uh-oh. To see how long it takes to
I've
get
I've come
in.
To know Rachel pretty well.
Yes. I mean this in a wonderful way, and I do want to share a story. On the campaign trail, I promised that I was going to visit with a group of individuals in the MCI Norfolk. Mm. And the overwhelming majority of them are serving natural life without the possibility of parole. They've committed
We've
a homicide.
We've got about a minute and a half.
Yes, very quickly. Well, when I went to go visit as the district attorney, I was not treated well. And that is not about my ego. The Boston Police Department officer that was with me as my detail, I showed my badge. I was not allowed in for over half an hour. I was asked why I was there. I was asked if I had an appointment. The governor, the AG, the district attorney, state representatives don't need an appointment there. If I, as the DA, am treated this way when I go to visit people in jail, I can't imagine what people's families who don't have credentials are treated like when they go to visit their loved one in Norfolk. Not to mention it took me an hour to drive there and there's no public transportation.
Right.
So we have to start talking about these issues.
Yep.
A lot.
I think we're going to have another hour. Suffolk County Ooh. DA Rachel Rollins, thanks for
thank
being
you.
With us. Commissioner Gross,
thank you.
And Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins,
thank
thanks
you so
to you as
thank
well.
You.
That's
mm-hmm.
our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.